From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, how a new partnership between WisHope and the Ripon Police Department hopes to address addiction. Then we speak with a local advocate for opioid awareness and research who's just 17 years old.
Frankly, I just want to give back to my community. And I believe the best way to give back to one's community is to take what you're good at and use it to help others. So for me, I've always loved science. I've always loved specifically neuroscience.
Plus, muralist Vidal Hill talks about the importance of public art and its messaging.
A lot of the work I've done was to use my art form as a vehicle to teach mainly youth about their opportunities, about the things that's out there.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Drug and alcohol abuse and addiction are a nationwide problem, and Wisconsin is no exception. To help address this issue, the Ripon Police Department is bringing in outside help as a part of the Fond du Lac County Opioid Initiative. In partnership with the organization WisHope, police officers now have 24/7 access to a peer recovery coach with lived addiction experience to help provide support and treatment options to those who need it. To find out more about this new partnership, I'm joined by Peter Brunzel, Executive Director of WisHope, and Bill Wallner, Chief of Police for the City of Ripon Police Department. Chief Wallner begins by explaining how the Ripon Police Department had been dealing with the growing opioid crisis.
We had, just like a lot of communities in the state of Wisconsin, within the last few years have been dealing with a crisis across the state and quite frankly across the nation concerning opioid addiction. One of the issues that we saw as we continued with that, obviously we know because of our partnerships that we have in the community as well as within the county, that this is an issue that we just couldn't we felt arrest our way out of. We know that in order to effectively combat opioid addiction and other addictions, we need to have partnerships. And this partnership with WisHope offers us the opportunity to do some things to problem solve some issues that were occurring within our department and our community that we were seeing that were inhibiting us from being able to effectively offer help to those people facing addiction issues. The major issue that we were seeing was that we were having people that we were dealing with involved in opioid addiction issues that were either coming in and asking our officers for help or officers were having contact with them. And then there was a struggle there about resources, you know, and that's for a variety of reasons, whether it's the officer not sure who they need to call, or trying to make phone calls to get this person the help that they're looking for, to be able to effectively do that in a timely fashion for these people, was very difficult for our officers. We had people coming in and begging for help, but we couldn't get them the resources that they need or needed at that time when they were looking for that help. So what WisHope allowed us to do is solve one of those major issues, is that when somebody's looking for help or we identify somebody that we think needs help, we're able to get them in contact with a resource coach right away to get the help that they're looking for. And that was often, like I said, the stumbling block for us. So it's really helped us with our history that we've been battling with opioid addiction. And we've been very impressed with the program so far and the people that we've been able to assist. So it's really answered a lot of problems and questions for us and given those resources to our community.
Now, Peter, we've had you on before, but it's been a while. So briefly, can you reacquaint our audience with WisHope and the unique feature that is the peer recovery coaches?
Sure. So we do training, and then we also provide peer recovery coaches to first responders, police departments, hospitals, counties, drug courts. And what we're doing is simply training people to be able to be that middle ground between the role that somebody's in, like Chief Wallner, versus us being able to connect them with care. So Chief Wallner has his role. A lot of people at the county have their role. If they're at a drug court, they have their role. How can we connect somebody to the care they need in real time, but also stay connected with them? So even if they don't want services right now, how can we be in their life if they let us? If they want to keep using or doing whatever they're doing, knowing that somebody with lived experience is in front of them or on the phone, being able to connect to them. So there's no judgment, there's no stigma around it. It's just another person who has the same experience, just being there in their life. If whatever direction they're looking for to have a little bit more of a well-rounded and balanced life.
Chief Wallner, you mentioned scenarios in which people are coming to police looking for help and resources, but when you respond to a scene, what is the protocol that's followed? You mentioned, you know, you can't arrest your way out of a problem. So I'm just looking for that insight of what typically would happen in a scene like that.
Yeah, obviously every call and every situation is different. Where WISHOPE allows us or gives us an opportunity here is that so often when we get involved in those calls, if somebody needs to be arrested, or there's times where somebody needs to be arrested and taken into custody, depending on what behavior they've been involved with. However, oftentimes the responsibilities of police officers have changed so much over the last 30 years to now incorporate, you know, many more calls involving mental health, addiction issues, those type of things. So when we get those calls and we can speak with the parties that are involved, it may be that person, you know, that's been involved in some type of conduct that, and that's why we're there dealing with them to, and getting to know them, and through conversations, you know, identify those addiction issues, and that it's so call dependent that a lot of times that can be different. You know, I can give you one example is that we recently had a call where we were called to a residence because a parent had called about an adult child that they had living with them who was suffering from some addiction issues, but was also having some crisis within their life. So our officers responded to that, were able to make contact with the subject. He was eventually taken into custody. However, through discussions with the family, we recognized, or the officers recognized, that, hey, there's an opportunity here for this person, once they're released from custody, to maybe make a connection with WISHOPE. So we set up a meeting with one of the recovery coaches and the family right away, which they were able to establish some things prior to that subject being released from custody, to have those things in place so that when there was a support system that was available for that person once they were released. Now, obviously, there was some behavior there that has to be addressed in the criminal justice system, but having that opportunity to have that support set up once that person's released from custody, where we're not just releasing them back into the community with no added support for them or the family to address the real underlying issues that exist there to change behavior and to help that family. And that's what WISHOPE was able to do for us.
Peter, with your insight, how do you think having a peer recovery coach on the scene can impact a person struggling with addiction? You know, and have you had to do any additional training for your peer recovery coaches with this new partnership with Ripon PD?
All of them are pretty familiar with the process. So as far as first responder or police, it's part of that training in the beginning. So it's what we do as far as building that connection and having resources available. So we do our due diligence on, you know, if we're stepping into a new area, like we've never been in Ripon before, I've never been there before. And it was such a new place. So we did our due diligence, and we have a resource map on our website for the entire state of Wisconsin, so that anybody can go on there. And that's where the peers start to help to be able to locate where somebody could go if they're looking for help, or how we can connect them. And that can be anywhere from a detox, residential, outpatient, basic resource, any community engagement around recovery, and how we can find that in those areas and make sure that we're connecting them to that care.
Chief Wallner, you mentioned that the role of police officers has changed so much over the last 30 years and some change. But when it comes to training with for interactions with people or responding to people struggling with addiction, is there a lot of training in place?
Yeah, we use a lot of the same tools and techniques that we do to communicate with people with addiction issues as we do with their mental health. You know, so those crisis intervention training that we put our officers through really helps us to deal with that. Specifically, and I know we're talking about addiction issues, but I would estimate that our involvement with mental health people in mental health crisis, I would say in the 30 years that I've been on this job, has probably gone up 300%. We're dealing with people with mental health issues nearly every day, several times a day, you know, whether that's a welfare check or somebody in crisis. And a lot of times, those people that have mental health issues may be dependent on alcohol or other drugs to supplement that mental health issue. So we use a lot of the same training for our officers to deal with mental health as we do with some of those underlying alcohol or drug addiction issues, because a lot of times we find that those go hand in hand. So the role of the police officer, especially in our community, has changed substantially, because for a lot of people, quite frankly, contact with law enforcement may be the only way that they get introduced into the system to help with those other issues. Maybe they've been struggling with addiction for some time, and it's not until law enforcement interaction with them that we're able to make that introduction with somebody like WisHope. So it's very important for the community to have that opportunity there, and really for the officers to be able to have that immediate resource, that 24/7 resource available to them to make those connections.
And this partnership comes at a time where people across the nation are calling for defunding the police, in part due to the fact that officers can't adequately respond to all situations. You can't be a social worker, you can't be a peer recovery coach, can't be all these things at once. So do you believe partnerships like this should be a widespread part of police reform going forward in the current climate?
Well, I can speak for our agency. We are very high on partnerships within the community. That does several things. Number one, it provides transparency for your organization, because you're dealing with partnerships, you're dealing with other members of the community. So it provides that transparency that is so desperately needed in law enforcement right now. It creates those relationships that are needed between members of the community and their local police departments. So in addition to, you know, the social work aspect that is now so heavily involved with law enforcement, which, you know, we're dealing with things today that we didn't deal with 20 years ago on these, you know, the social work aspect or community aspect. So partnerships are definitely, in my opinion and in my organization, very important. And I would be a voice for any law enforcement leader. You know, we're constantly looking for ways for organizations to improve and improve that relationship with communities. And forming strong partnerships allows you to do that. So I am a very strong proponent of that. That's why, you know, we're one of the first agencies, I think, in the county here to be involved with WisHope. And I've told Peter and I've told his staff that I've been so impressed with the work that they're doing and the relationship that we've established that I'm willing to speak with any law enforcement chief or that needs, you know, that has questions about the program or is thinking about the program. I think it's that important to your community to be able to do that. And I think it's important that your community recognize that we're in this together, and law enforcement cannot tackle this issue of addiction that's raging across our state on our own. It has to be done with partnerships. And that's why programs like this are so important.
How do you both hope this changes the stigma and conversation around addiction in our communities, and how community members engage with trying to help better the situation?
I think decriminalizing, like the whole concept of it, is that beginning piece of bringing about a change to the culture around what addiction is, how we view substance abuse and how we treat it. So behavior is one thing, addiction is another, right? So there's different things happening when police get involved quite often. So knowing that there is a differentiating there, and really looking, I go to the big picture and looking at total reform, of course, because that's my role in life, right? I see that, what can we do? Can we do a different approach across the board? And hopefully these engagements like this is where it starts, right? And this is that awareness building piece for the whole system to start to shift. And so that we'll have less people possibly in our jails and in our prisons that could be getting help in a different way instead of going there. So if it's, we're directing that like direction toward getting help instead of just locking somebody up, or behavior is different. That's a different thing if that behavior is involved. But if it's addiction specific, we should probably look at that quite differently. And hopefully this is that tip of the spear where we're starting to do that in our communities.
Yeah, I certainly agree with Peter on those points. Historically, if you look at thoughts of law enforcement, maybe in the past had been, okay, I go out there and I arrest somebody for behavior, throw them in jail, and that's it. And then I'm done with them. This provides an opportunity for our officers to, you know, think about those underlying issues and to provide that support and to maybe make that introduction to say, you know, yeah, maybe the behavior here was bad and we can, you know, there's some consequences for that. But what really is the underlying issue? And if that's an addiction issue, alcohol or drug addiction issue, maybe we can offer some support there to address that problem that's underlying the issue. So, you know, to change that thinking in law enforcement can sometimes be an uphill battle, but, you know, our officers have, you know, embraced this program. They understand the importance of it in problem solving and that community relations, and really as a part of what the community does. So, I agree with what Peter's saying there as well.
Peter Brunzel is the executive director of WISHOPE, and Bill Wallner is the chief of police for the City of Ripon Police Department. Coming up next, we meet a Milwaukee teen who is also working on changing the opioid crisis. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Most teenagers' worlds revolve around school, friends, and family. But one Milwaukee teen has already dedicated himself to fighting the opioid epidemic. Neil Dogra is a 17-year-old high school junior from Milwaukee and the founder of the Opioid Epidemic Awareness Campaign. He combines his interest in neuroscience, public speaking, and peer advocacy to speak at middle and high schools, meet policy advisors on opioid education, and reform. Dogra also does research at UW-Milwaukee and the Medical College of Wisconsin on the side. To learn more about how Dogra was drawn to service, he joins me now. Neil Dogra, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me.
So you are 17 years old. You just finished up your junior year of high school. And out of all the things that could catch your attention and be the focus of your mind, why the opioid epidemic?
So I've lived here my entire life. And until I was a freshman in high school, I had really never heard of the opioid epidemic or frankly what an opioid even was. So when I heard a radio talk right here on WUWM, and I found out that opioid overdoses are the leading cause of non-natural deaths in Milwaukee, I was really taken aback that I had no idea what was going on. And at that point, my only goal was really, what can I do to help as a student?
What do you think compels you to act in this way in service?
So essentially, I believe that as a citizen of Milwaukee, this city's given me so many opportunities, from the research opportunities, the incredible people I've worked with in my service journey. Frankly, I just want to give back to my community. And I believe the best way to give back to one's community is to take what you're good at and use it to help others. So for me, I've always loved science. I've always loved specifically neuroscience. So when I found out that neurobiology is at the crux of this epidemic, I thought this was a great opportunity for me to give back to the city.
Before we get to your research, I do want to talk about the opioid epidemic awareness campaign that you founded. So what's that primary mission and who's your target audience?
So I would say the most key part of my identity is that I am a high school student. I think that is at the crux of my work with the opioid epidemic. When I found out about this epidemic, it is really complex. It's multifaceted. There are so many levels. Frankly, I don't even understand all of what's going on. And so it was kind of overwhelming to think, what can I do to help as just a high schooler? But as I've grown more comfortable with what I'm doing, I've learned that that's actually one of the most rewarding parts of this process is that I'm a high schooler, because I'm able to target my audience being other students more effectively. I think the key part of a successful awareness campaign is trust and honesty. And as a peer, as just another student, I'm able to relate to my audience, other high schoolers, rather effectively.
And what is the current state of the opioid epidemic with people your age in high school?
So opioids are actually fairly prevalent with kids my age. When I found out about this epidemic, I figured it was, I would think that opioids are kind of the last step in an addict's journey. So they would start with something like a gateway drug. That's what I learned in school. They would start with cigarettes or alcohol and slowly work their way up to heroin. What I failed to realize is that heroin is not the only opioid. So yes, there are illegal synthetic opioids like heroin or carfentanil, but there are also legally prescribed opioids that kids my age are getting from their doctors. So at my age, a common procedure would be wisdom tooth removal. And following this procedure, it's very common that a kid is prescribed a painkiller like OxyContin. Or if we have a really nasty cough, it's very common that we get something like codeine. And when used as a doctor prescribes it, these can be safe and effective, no doubt. But these are actually very chemically similar to things like heroin and fentanyl. So it is very easy to make that jump from something legal to something that's very illegal, very potent, and very dangerous.
You mentioned that the primary lesson you were learning in school is that the opioid epidemic stems off of a gateway drug, but that's not the case. And this is the lesson that many kids are learning. So is this also part of the reason why you work within the school systems to present more accurate information about the opioid epidemic?
Absolutely. I think every middle schooler, every elementary schooler really receives some form of drug education these days. At various points in my schooling, I received some sort of education on different drugs. The thing is, as a 10 to 12 year old, learning about heroin doesn't seem awfully compelling because it's just sort of like, when would I ever encounter something so awful? But what we fail to realize is we can encounter something very chemically similar at this age. And it's important that we get that knowledge out there for students.
One thing that many people also don't realize or think of, and in part due to stigma, is that addiction is a brain disease. Where do you think the public lays in understanding this, and how has your work helped to really hone in on this important part of the problem of addiction?
So ultimately, the three takeaways of my opioid epidemic awareness campaign and what students can do to help are learn, teach, and support. So the first step is learning what's going on, and that's really why I give these presentations and try to inform other students. The next step is to advocate what we've learned, but that third and most crucial step is to support the addicts that are going through this awful disease. Often we recognize addiction as a moral failure, but the truth is this is a brain disease. Literally, addicts have a different neurochemistry that makes it incredibly difficult to stop using. So it's not just a matter of willpower. It is a medical disease that requires help from a healthcare professional.
With your hands also involved in research, what have you been working on with UW-Milwaukee and in turn the Medical College of Wisconsin? And how did this opportunity come to you? Many high schoolers probably don't think it's yet an option to do research with these kind of places unless perhaps you're a college student or you have an internship.
Absolutely. So like I said, I first was introduced to the opioid epidemic right here on this radio talk. And it was a talk by two UW-Milwaukee professors named Dr. Tina Freiberger and Dr. Melinda Cavanaugh. And they had been conducting a case study of opioid overdoses, looking at the trends and the commonalities in this really complex and, like I said, multifaceted epidemic. So the first step in my work with the opioid epidemic was actually just to reach out to these professors. And they were very kind and supportive, enough so that they actually let me into their lab or their research project. So what we looked at was overdose cases. And what we were trying to do is piece together a narrative. So we looked at criminal histories, medical histories. I even went through social media to look for contacts. And what I found was that time and time again, opioids were not being used alone. So yes, they were using, these addicts were using things like heroin or OxyContin, but they were also being prescribed things like benzodiazepines, Xanax, or other treatments for anxiety, because at the end of the day, mental health is a risk factor for addiction. The thing is, these benzodiazepines, this class of medications for anxiety, actually lowers heart rate and breathing rates, just like opioids do. So when they're used together, the risk of an overdose skyrockets. So having learned that, my goal was, can we get a better way to treat anxiety? And with that in mind, I reached out to a professor at the medical college in the Neuroscience Research Center, and I started working toward that goal. And so what I found is that our body actually produces these molecules called endocannabinoids that naturally combat anxiety. They regulate the intensity and types of chemicals flowing through our brain at any given moment. So with that in mind, I found that a metabolite of household Tylenol, which is something that I think most people would have in their house, actually elevates the level of these molecules. And in doing so, we can regulate the intensity and frequency of different chemicals within our brains to reach a more balanced chemical makeup. Now, I do want to point out that household Tylenol can't do this on its own, so I definitely would not advise, you know, swallowing Tylenol. But this metabolite is in many ways safer than the commonly prescribed pills. So it's definitely something with a lot of potential for future treatments of anxiety.
And what drew you to neuroscience in the first place?
Well, I've always been fascinated with STEM in general. Really where I became involved with neuroscience was in my freshman biology class. I thought it was very fascinating that our brain is so complex and there's just so much going on the biology side, on the chemistry side, that can have such meaningful outcomes on the macroscopic level, that these little molecules that are microscopic can have such vast effects on our bodies, on our mindsets.
You've also not only just in making lessons and curriculum to present to your fellow students in other schools in the city, but also you use filmmaking as a tool to help spread the message. So you have access to so many different outlets. What have you learned about either yourself or the way you can reach people in trying out all of these different ways of spreading the message?
So I, coming into my freshman year, would have never thought that I would do really any of this. I did not consider myself a filmmaker or a neuroscience researcher. And I just want students to know that the best way to learn about yourself is to help others. Had I never picked up this passion for opioids, I would have never learned that I enjoy filmmaking. I would have never considered that I could be a filmmaker. But in helping my community, I'm also learning a lot about myself, my passions, and my potential.
And who have been any mentors or people helping along the way? You mentioned the two UW professors, but, you know, it's definitely a unique thing to have someone still in high school just carry this mission so clearly.
Yeah, so many. I really could not have done this without the amazing adults and healthcare professionals in our city. So those two UW Milwaukee professors, I mean, they took a pretty big step to let a high schooler come and join their case study. Frankly, I was pretty inexperienced. But they were able to show me the ropes and support me until I could be of use. Additionally, my mentor at the medical college, her name is Dr. Cece Hillard. She again let me into her lab and taught me and mentored me to a point where I could follow my passion. But there are also so many countless individuals that have helped me along the way. I've talked to recovering addicts who now serve as counselors. For example, in West Allis, the first 24/7 treatment center in Milwaukee just opened up. It's called Community Medical Services. So there's a doctor there named Dr. Timothy Allen, who's helped me with my documentary and really just taught me about this really complex brain disease.
You're 17 and so involved in opioid addiction and the crisis when many adults and your peers would expect it to be more than sufficient and acceptable just to concentrate on your schooling and, you know, the goal of college like many high school students have. So how have you been able to balance all of this?
Yeah, most definitely it can be difficult. It can be stressful, but it's also definitely worth it. I will point out that the two are not completely independent. So the things I'm learning with the opioid epidemic in turn help me understand what I'm learning in AP chemistry, for example. So because this is an epidemic that's so prevalent and so multifaceted, there are so many topics that I've studied within the epidemic that actually help me with what I'm learning in my AP classes or help me with the cognitive abilities that are required for an SAT. So I will say that it's definitely stressful at times, but it's also absolutely doable for really any high school student if you're committed and you're passionate enough.
Would that be your message to other people within your age group, is that you have the potential to do much more right now and you don't have to wait for college or anything like that?
100%. It doesn't have to be the opioid epidemic. I would really just encourage every high school student or even middle school student or younger to pick up a passion and follow it to its full potential.
Now, you've already got a foot in the door concerning research and working with college professors in the Medical College of Wisconsin. So you have one more year of high school to go, but what is your long game plan? Is neuroscience something you want to focus on for college?
100%. So ultimately, I'm looking to go into a career in medicine, specifically, hopefully, with neuroscience. I'm in contact with professors at universities that I'm going to apply to, no matter where I go, and I don't really know where that is as of now, but I definitely want to continue with neuroscience research throughout my undergraduate years and really into my career at large.
With Milwaukee springboarding your introduction to this crisis, when it comes to learning more, and obviously this is a nationwide, you know, worldwide issue here, how do you see your research changing course or work outside of Milwaukee influencing some of the work that needs to be done in the city yet? Because policies could make a big difference, not just here in the county, but nationwide.
Right. So it is affecting Milwaukee, most definitely. We are hit very difficultly with this epidemic, but it is a nationwide and frankly international crisis. So it's important that we connect with researchers, not just in Milwaukee, but all over the world, as well as legislators. So there is some very successful research going down at Northwestern right now. I'm in contact with a professor there. So he's actually designing an implantable device that can detect an opioid overdose and then immediately alert first responders and deliver a dose of naloxone, which is an opioid reversing drug. So things like that can most definitely make an impact with this epidemic. It is a social issue. It definitely requires work on the political level, but also on the biological, biomedical engineering level. There's a lot to do, and there is a lot of great people that can get the job done.
Well, and I know you'll be one of the great people involved, and I'm sure we'll have you back on to discuss some research that is published in the future, at the very least. So, Neil, thank you so much for your time and for your work.
Thank you so much.
Neil Dogra is a high school student from Milwaukee, founder of the Opioid Epidemic Awareness Campaign, and published STEM researcher. Dogra will be giving a TEDx talk on his work and service August 15th in Fond du Lac. The event will also be available virtually. Coming up next, we have a conversation with local muralist V-Dale Hill. Like Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. One of the most iconic parts of the recent protests here in Milwaukee are the many murals that have sprung up around the city. These pieces on streets and walls provide tangible expressions of the energy behind these demonstrations. V-Dale Hill has been a part of this movement, both as an activist and an artist. Although his Black Lives Matter mural covering the intersection of North Martin Luther King Drive and West Locust Street was washed away, the piece was not just a visual reminder of the movement. It was a community effort in the heart of the city's Harambee neighborhood. Hill joins Lake Fextoy Powers to talk about his work and its impact.
So, just to start here, how did you first become involved in the protests?
So, naturally, as an artist, I've done work that relates to my upbringing and living in Milwaukee and my experiences. And it was a natural connection to a lot of the protests, a lot of the feelings of being unheard, unseen, and unappreciated or underappreciated, and simply not treated humanely. And that's how I've become involved, because it was natural for me. My work already covered those subjects. The things I've been trying to affect change on have been systemic racism, even classism and education disparities, opportunities, food deserts. So a lot of the work I've done was to use my art form as a vehicle to teach mainly youth about their opportunities, about the things that's out there. And I feel one of the biggest things is misinformation or not accessing information freely in the urban setting. We have to drive half an hour to get to the nearest place for good health care or good food that's naturally grown. We have quick access to things that are harmful for us, both our health and our finances. Predatory lending, everything we have access to immediately and all the information about are harmful. But my work with Homeworks Bronzeville addresses the housing issues. My work as an artist addresses a lot of the social cues that happen consistently. And a lot of people are looking for people to just simply hear them. I mean, when me saying my life matters is met with a debate, that in itself is ridiculous. I'm not against anyone. I'm for me. And that's harmful. And not trying to impede on anyone's rights, anyone's obligations to take care of their families or whatever that may be, but simply me stating I am a man who should be treated with respect first and foremost, I have to prove that I should be respected. I have to jump through hoops to be looked at as an equal. And I feel like a lot of the work I do through housing, through fine arts, through education, through a lot of the public projects I do, it addresses all these things in one.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of people are going to know you as a muralist, maybe first and foremost. Inside of this movement, what do you think murals bring to the conversation that other forms of protest can't in the same way?
So one of the major things that attracted me to art as a career in my ability to tell a story in a painting or in a sculpture or an installation, I believe the biggest thing art does is it lies to the people to tell them the truth. It comes off as fake. So when I paint a person, that's not a real person. That's a painting of a person. We lie to tell the truth while politicians act as if they're telling the truth to lie. And I feel like that's what's happening. The artists get to sugarcoat the things that are hard to digest, the things that people don't want to address and can. Obviously, for years, you can avoid serious conversation that I will not be treated the same way as my white counterpart. And he didn't have to do anything for that to happen, nor did I. So we simply address the truth through facades, which are paintings and sculptures and beautiful flowers and young ladies with a mask on that said, I can't breathe. And she's a beautiful young girl and painted, and everyone can enjoy that. So we lie to tell the truth while a lot of politicians act as if they're telling the truth. They hide behind skewed statistics and use it, they talking points, and they just continue to do the same things that's happened over and over. I'm treated slightly better than my father, but not humanely. That doesn't make me happy. I'm not satisfied with being treated slightly better than my father, who should have been respected in the first place.
Yeah. You know, a lot of the concepts and the issues that you're talking about, when you think about them, they don't necessarily bring up an image. How do you take these concepts that can feel more abstract in some ways, but have a real life impact? How do you take those ideas and make them an image, make them visual?
So, We as humans across this planet, we have some certain things that are just universally understood or felt. And those are usually through those emotional cues, not language, not necessarily cultural things. For example, not the vehicles we enjoy or the pastimes we enjoy, but the art. We all know what looks good to us. It doesn't have to be an equal, like I like red flowers, you can like yellow flowers, we both enjoy beauty. That's the thing. We don't have to enjoy beauty the same way. We don't have to enjoy the feeling of success the same way. I could feel great and successful when I complete a painting, and another person can feel successful when they complete a sale because they're a sales rep. And that joy is universal. That understanding of beauty is universal. The understanding of taking pride in caring for your family, whether you're man, woman, child, whomever, those things are universal. So how do you depict them is the question. And it's through a lot of color usage. There's a lot of color association. We're talking about this right now. Black is negative and white is positive, and that's how the world sometimes sees it. That's the story that's being told. But there's nuances to it. And we just, as artists, we manipulate color and scale to see something the size of a building changes something. To see it the size of a sheet of standard paper says something. So we use scale, color usage, and imagery in a universally understood appreciation for beauty. And joy, like music, does the same thing. So does dance. Whether you're great at it, or I stand on the wall. Whether you're great at it, or you're the guy just holding up the wall, you can enjoy the feeling of community when music is playing. And those are the things artists try to create. We try to depict these situations of what we want opposed to what we don't want. I often find myself in conversations about what should happen, not what shouldn't happen, because we keep seeing what shouldn't happen. That's what the headlines are, is what shouldn't have happened. That cop shouldn't have done that. That person shouldn't have done that, or that company shouldn't have done that. What should they have done is the real conversation. And that's the meat of it, is they should look at every application with no name and choose the person. With no, why do I have to check a box to say my ethnicity? Why do they have a standard where they say they have to hire at least 15% and then be forced to, because they simply won't look at people for who they are and what they do, but rather like how they look or what neighborhood they grew up in and those kind of things. And that's what art is doing. That's why we're trying to depict what should be, what is a beautiful child out there speaking their mind or standing for something. How could anyone be against that?
Well, and some people look at these street murals, in particular the murals that are on the street, as a kind of graffiti, which raises the question, you know, what is the difference between street art and graffiti?
Well, there's multiple differences in art in general. Myself, I identify as an artist. I mean, I try to get my message across, whether it's sculpture, mural painting, or painting on a canvas in my studio that'll go in a gallery in another country. I see myself as an artist. But for me, what's understood is street more or less is a person doing it because they absolutely want to. There's no like business transaction involved. They're just speaking their mind through art, whether it's wheat pasting, stenciling, painting, chalk art, whatever it may be. It's from that person. It's a message from that person directly. There is no like contractual obligation to do this or that. And murals are in between fine arts and street art. There's a transaction involved, but there's also community involvement. There's usually some kind of input or message from a collective. Rather, it's one artist painting it. The idea had to be shared at some point. It may probably had to get approved. So there's different degrees of freeness to what's happening. Some people are doing gigantic street art that if it was a commodity, they would have been paid thousands. But they express themselves through it. And if they feel that's fine, fine. But also at the same time, there's someone making a transaction to do one. And there's another person who's spilling hate. Let's be honest, some people who are just anti whatever. I mean, anti-happiness, anti-growth, because stagnant is where a lot of people do well in this country. When it's stagnant, there are an entire class of people who do well with things not changing because they never had to adapt. never had to change. Not to say everyone struggles. That's universal. But some people have umbrellas and some don't. Some people have a place to go when it's raining and some don't. Some people are helped across the street and given an umbrella, and some are just spat on while it's raining. So there's varying degrees of growth that needs to happen. And street art, murals, and graffiti, they all have a place. What doesn't have a place is the hatred. It should be a message for something, not necessarily against something.
When you're doing these street murals, do you get permits to do them, or is this something that that you could be potentially fined for?
So me personally, I'm usually requested to do the murals I do. There's usually some entity, whether city, private, company, an organization. I'm usually sought after to produce it with youth, with community. So that's usually where I fall in there, and permits involved. There's surveys involved. Often there's some kind of community involvement where they're actually painting with me, and sometimes they're not. They just have input on what's going up. So for me, I'm not really worried about like permits or anything like that. It's usually part of a job for me, but it's a job that I see needs to happen. We need positive imagery of Black men. Often we're just judged by what's seen in the media, or a 15-second clip, not seeing the beginning nor the end of what happened. So for me to depict things that should be, or things that really get to the meat of the issues, systemic issues, those are where minds lie. And I wouldn't want to ruin that with an argument or fight or a political battle over if I had the right to do it or not. Because what it does is it yells over a real situation. It's yelling during a debate. So I have to cross my T's and dot my I's. Otherwise, sometimes my message can get lost in the permitting aspect of it, or the community involvement aspect of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. So as we look to the future of these protests, these demonstrations in general, what are your plans? Do you plan to do more murals or collaborate with other artists?
Yeah, so for me, someone asked me that, and I mentioned it a few times before in other interviews, and someone asked me, like, what am I going to do about these things that are going on? And I've been doing the work. I've started Giselle's Art Studio with my brother in 2012 to address youth having something positive to do, having food. They can come do art and see Black men doing positive things for their neighborhood. I've been doing the work of talking to businesses about giving back to the community. Often the businesses in the inner city, especially Harambe, Imani, River West, Bronzeville area, even in the south side, north side. So those are pipeline out businesses. They'll profit all day as a corner store and never give a cent. Might not even maintain their property well. There's so many pipelines out of our community that I address it through, like, if you want to really invest in this community that you're making money off of, really invest. I hire 5 kids a quarter to clean. I mean, you have to do something, because at that point, these stores just take. A lot of these businesses just take from our people, and they're the same ones following us around the store, calling the police because I paid for something, then I came back in to get something else, and now they think I took that, and they didn't give me a receipt. So now there's a kid who probably has a petty theft thing on their record because the store owner doesn't care, or the business doesn't care about the people who are making their business profitable. So we address that through, like, hire them. Let's do some mural out here, or have some kind of cleanup club, or whatever it may be. Just do something positive. I mean, that's what I've been doing. I've been addressing these things through murals, through fine arts, through education. Now teaching at Maya as an adjunct professor, I'm working with young adults, and seeing where their head is and seeing how they can contribute to their community, whether it's here or not. I mean, their community can be in Michigan. That's fine, but this is a universal issue. It should be natural for a company or a business to do well by the people that make them function, that make them profitable. And often that's not happening. And I address that through consulting, through art projects, through community projects, through cleanups, through just mentoring. I mean, if anybody is hearing this that I've mentored, I mean, say something. I've always given opportunities to self-taught artists to just come out and learn different techniques and learn how to draw up a business plan or write up a proposal. I've done this for years. And these are even peers of mine. I mean, some of my mentees are older than I am. I'm only 32, and I've been doing this for as long as I can remember. If I can help, I'm going to help.
Yeah. Well, Video, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
Milwaukee native Vidale Hill is an activist, teacher, and artist whose murals have been a part of the recent protests here in the city. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.